Beloved, hear the word of God from Genesis chapter 34, verses 1 through 20 this morning. I'm not going to read all 20 verses. We'll read the beginning section and the end section. We'll work through the middle in the sermon. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had born to Jacob, went out to see the women of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he seized her and lay with her and humiliated her. And his soul was drawn to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this girl for my wife." Now Jacob heard that he had defiled his daughter Dinah, but his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob held his peace until they came. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. And the sons of Jacob had come in from the field as soon as they had heard of it. And the men were indignant and very angry because he had done an outrageous thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing must not be done. Now down to verse 24. And all who went out of the gate of his city listened to Hamor and his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. And on the third day, when they were sore, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and came against the city while it felt secure and killed all the males. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the sword and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went away. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds, their donkeys and whatever was in the city and in the field, and all their wealth, all their little ones and their wives, all that was in the house, they captured and plundered. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me a stink to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household." But they said, "Should he treat our sister like a prostitute?" Ever so often in Genesis, in the Bible in general, we come across stories that report such horrible stuff that some commentators and some teachers just ignore it. They skip past it. They don't talk about it. And our text this morning is one of those passages. It tells of the rape of Jacob Israel's daughter Dinah by Prince Shechem, son of Hamor, king of the city-state of Shechem. That little town, as it was then in the early Bronze Age, sits between two large hills, Ebal and Gerizim. You might remember that those are the hills on which the children, the tribes of Israel, divide themselves, climb up and read the blessings and the curses of the law and shout them to one another. You might remember it as the place where Jacob dug a well. And in John, Jesus encounters the woman at the well. And it is right there at a well that Jacob dug in the valley between the mountains of Ebal and Gerizim. So interesting, amazing, gospel stuff is going to go on in this little town. But what's going on here now is really quite nasty and horrible. This passage records the bloody revenge of the sons of Israel. And commentators like Arthur Pink and Alexander McLaren just skip the passage by entirely. One Old Testament scholar, the excellent Hebraist H.C. Leupold, a very good conservative Lutheran scholar, makes exegetical notes on the text. But he doubts anybody with proper discernment ever drew a sermon out of Genesis 34. Now, fortunately for us, other scholars besides Dr. Leupold and other preachers have covered this text with varying degrees of clarity, some better, some worse, but we're going to take a stab at it because it's here in the Word of God. And we believe it is edifying for us and here for us to learn something about. So what we know for certain is that the patriarchs of the faith were exactly like you and me. They struggled constantly with disbelief. They were simultaneously saints and sinners. And it was God's loyalty, love for his people. Not the people's love for God, but God's chesed, his loyalty, love for his people that saved both them and us. Just as in our text last week, where Jacob feared his brother's wrath and failed to speak the truth in love to Esau and settled outside the promised land in favor of better pastures for his flocks for several years, we see Jacob Israel this morning being way more Jacob than he is Israel. Moses doesn't sugarcoat the human condition. And I like that about him. He just tells us what happens. Jacob has certainly had his spiritual highs and lows from chapters 25 up to this point in chapter 34. At times, he's been shifty and self-reliant. And at times, he's acted admirably. He saw God face to face following the great smackdown along the Yabbok River. He wants to know this God and to kind of not know this God at the same time, mostly like you and me. I mean, we sing that we want to love God. We sing that we want to know God. But when it comes right down to it, we really don't want to know him or love him that much, because it might just take over our life. It might make too much of a difference between our schemes and our human wisdom and what we want. This guy saw God face to face, and he was forced to confess his name, Yaakov, the name that had represented him and spoke of him all his life, the supplanter, the cheat, the schemer. And the pre-incarnate promised seed wrestled with him and renamed him Yisrael. May God fight for him. That's the prayer of his name. And it's also a wordplay that comments upon his struggles with both God and men. And limping away from that encounter, he reconciled with his brother Esau and extended to him the honor that he had stolen and repaid him the property he would have inherited. But the meeting showed both Israel and Jacob at work. Bowing to the Eastern shame and honor culture, he lied about his intentions to join Esau in his kingdom rather than to share his covenant obligations that God had told him to stay in the promised land. He dallied in Sukkot to rebuild his flocks after giving so much away to his brother. And for years, he stayed out of the promised land. Then, when he finally entered, he settles just inside the promised land in a settled city of rank pagans, a city of trade. Probably not a really big city. There weren't a whole lot of really big cities in Canaan or the general area. It's more like a little walled town full of some people that are mostly traders, because the trade route funnels right through there between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim into that valley. And he looks around and he goes, hey, this is a happening place. And I've been kind of wandering for a while, and I've been off in Mesopotamia, and then I've been over the Yabbok River building my flocks. So I think I'm going to settle here. This is a cool-looking town with cool-looking people. It's hip. It's happening. I like it. I've been a hick for a while. I want my kids to have some friends. Who doesn't? So we'll just plop down right here. Except what he does is he plops down just like his great uncle Lot. This is a hip happening place, and I'm going to hang here for a while. And the results are exactly the same. Shechem was 20 miles from Bethel, Beit El, the house of God, where he'd vowed to go. So he's still only being halfway obedient to God. He did build an altar in Shechem, and he named it after God, but Shechem was not where Israel was supposed to be. R. Kent Hughes writes this in his commentary. The old Jacob was in full force. He was morally weak, unwilling to pay the cost of right actions, untrusting of God, and unmindful of the welfare of his children and the future of his people. People today say, home is where the heart is. I bet you've heard that hundreds, countless times. Home is where the heart is, right? That's probably what Jacob was saying. Ooh, my heart is here. This looks like home. And Jacob seemed to have set his heart on this little trading town, but for God's people, home is never where the heart is. Home is where the Lord is. The human heart is deceitfully wicked, so sings Jeremiah in Jeremiah 17:9. If the Lord is not controlling when and where we move and settle, then we are simply spiritual wanderers like Jacob, Israel, and like Lot before him. And the consequences, the Lord will ensure, will always be bad for you. Now, Jacob, Israel only had one daughter, Dinah. And her mother was the unloved Leah, at least the less loved Leah. And Leah's children were less favored by the patriarch. So as a female, Dinah would have had in this patriarchal culture much less value even than Leah's sons, who had less value than his favored wife's children. So add to that the fact that her father is functioning in mostly Jacob mode. He's not where he's supposed to be spiritually. He's not where he's supposed to be physically. So the family winds up with this teenage girl pushing the edges of societal boundaries. She kicks against the goads of custom by leaving the family compound for this unaccompanied trip to town. That just wasn't done back then. And the Hebrew grammar describes her actions with this sense of impropriety about it. It's best likely translated, she went out to be seen among the women of the land. She's stepping out. She wants to go not just see the women of the land, but be seen among the women of the land. By whom? By the eligible bachelors of the town, like Shechem, the most eligible bachelor of the town. The villain in this opening story is not Dinah, a teenage girl pushing her limits. It's not her fault she gets raped. I went to a university that believed that recently that women put themselves in compromising positions and deserve to get raped. Now that's just freaking horrible. I'm sorry. It's awful. So please don't misunderstand me. I'm not telling you Dinah deserved to get raped, because she did what teenage girls do, pushing the boundaries on their parents. Jacob wasn't being a very good father. Leah was a distracted mother. I mean, there's a lot of kids in this family and a lot of stuff to do and tons of herds to take care of. She takes advantage of the chaos and she slips out. It isn't her fault. It's the prince's fault. He's the villain. Shechem ben Hamor, the Hivite, is the villain. Verse 2. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he seized her and he lay with her and he humiliated her. Now, Hivite territory was not one big place. It was kind of wherever this tribe and their family members settled. There would be little Hivite compounds. So Shechem is a Hivite city, or walled mud hut town, if you will. One writer says the sequence, he saw her, he seized her, recalls the same sequence in the episode concerning the sons of God and the daughters of men. They saw, they seized. That is the Nephilim. They saw right before the flood. Things were so bad, they're just out taking whatever they want, including women. They see them, it looks good, they seize them, they take them. The same order occurs with Eve and the forbidden fruit in the garden. She saw, she took. First comes the desire, and then the action when the lust is not checked. So these three verbs here in verse 2, saw, seized, raped, describe this progression of aggravated sexual assault that's made utterly worse by the fact that this young man is a prince. Luther writes this, "The evil examples of the magnates and princes are the most pestilential of all and have a very wide influence, for they corrupt many and draw them to license and sinning. The sins of princes are plainly diabolical, so they are punished in a severe manner, as Shechem was, for he thought that anything was permitted him as a prince, and he paid a horrible penalty. It cost him his neck. He himself and his parents and the whole city perish in a wretched manner. So Shechem became consumed with his conquest, perhaps more in an idolatrous way than in a romantic way. Verse 3, and his soul was drawn to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman, and he spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, get me this girl for my wife. Now we might say Shechem was madly in love. That would make a good Hollywood movie romance story. No. I raped her and I decide I'm in love with her. I don't think so. That's not going to get made. We might say he was in love, but it's doubtful that he knew how to distinguish passion from love. But at least he sought a proper marriage, even though he comes across sounding like this spoiled man-child. Daddy, get me this woman. And as shocking as Dinah's rape was, many commentators seem shocked by Jacob Israel's response. Verse 5. Now Jacob heard that he had defiled his daughter Dinah, but his sons were with the livestock in the field, so Jacob held his peace until they came. Now, I've read a lot of commentators and sermonators this week that take Jacob's silence as apathy. Well, he just clearly he doesn't care about anything because Moses doesn't assign him any dialogue here, so he's just sitting there doing nothing. Yeah, I don't care. Peel me a grape. I'm busy. I'll get to that sometime. No, that's just not out of character. That is so out of character for Jacob. It's out of character for any father, especially in a shame and honor culture like the ancient Near East. It's not that he's apathetic. This is Jacob. He is a man who has endured 20 years working for his slimy, cheating uncle and said nothing to him until he finally escapes. And the uncle catches up to him. Remember that? I mean, he held his peace for 20 years. So Jacob does and says nothing rationally, irrationally. He does everything rationally. He thinks, he plans, he keeps his cards close to his vest. In verse 26, we find out Haman was holding Dinah in his compound. So what rash, immediate action could Jacob have taken rationally that wouldn't endanger his daughter? So it's stupid to say that he's apathetic or lazy or doesn't care. That's just dumb. That's bad commentating. Disregard that. If you read it, tear it up and throw it away. That's stupid. That's not Jacob. 20 years of dealing with Laban had taught this guy to keep his mouth shut and to plan ahead and to rely on his own wits. Jacob's lack of immediate action, though, fuels the rage of his sons. Verse 7, the sons of Jacob had come in from the fields as soon as they heard of it, and the men were indignant and very angry because he had done an outrageous thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing must not be done. So they're furious. But at least the sons recognize the rape as demeaning to the infant nation of Israel. This is a crime perpetrated by a pagan people against the people of Yahweh. So to them, their father's quiet scheming is equal to him not fighting for his daughter or fighting for his God. How dare you just sit there and do nothing and say nothing? Something has to be done, and it has to be done right now. They're like surgeons. This has to be removed, and it needs to be removed right now, and the only way to cure it is to cut. So Hamor and Prince Shechem come to Jacob and his sons in verses 8 through 25, and they attempt to make a marriage covenant. And yet they do it without any sense of guilt. To them, this is just a small matter for which there's a reasonable and mutually beneficial solution. In their offer, they failed to mention two things. They make no mention of the prince raping Dinah, And they also leave out the fact that they're holding her hostage in their compound. They're quite willing, though, to make things right. And they certainly held the upper hand in doing that because they're holding the daughter. So look at verse 8. The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him to be his wife. Make marriages with us. Give us your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves. You shall dwell with us and the land shall be open to you. Dwell and trade in it and get property in it. In other words, hey man, no hard feelings. All right? You know kids today. They just kind of do that stuff. No big deal. Look, join us. We'll be bigger and stronger and all be wealthier. It'll all be good. It's all good, man. It's just a little hormones raging. Don't sweat it, okay? We'll make each other rich. You'll have property rights and freedom to travel and trade if you join us. Of course, that's the one thing that the people of Israel could not and would never do according to the law. Of course, they did, because we're all lawbreakers. But God said, it's the one thing you can't do. You can't intermarry and become a different, separate people. You could, if you were outside of Israel, come into Israel. How do you think the sons got wives? They got wives because they converted women to the one true God. Right? So that was perfectly acceptable. They could have said, oh, sure, well, let me tell you about the one true God. Okay? And oh, by the way, in order for you to have the sign and the seal of God's saving covenant, your men need to be circumcised. Yeah. That's why when you see in the New Testament, when you see that there were Gentiles who were called God-fearers, they're men. You know why they're men? Because they don't want to get circumcised. So they come to the temple and stand in the court of Gentiles. They go to studies and they talk to rabbis and some of them follow Jesus. This is a big deal. This is not antibiotic era stuff going on here. Okay? So you could bring people from outside Israel into Israel. But people from Israel could not go out into the outside and intermarry and intermingle with pagans and accept their gods. They did, of course. It's going to get them in a lot of trouble. But legally, God said, don't do that. So what is Hamor offering? He's offering them, just don't be a separate people. Come blend in with us, and you'll have everything. But here's the problem. God had already said you have everything. You own this land, right? This is yours. Now, credit to the sons of Jacob. They knew that. They got that. Bad on the sons of Jacob because they're not trying to convert these people. Verse 11, let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me, I will give. Ask me as great a bride price and gift as you will, and I will give whatever you say to me. Only give me the young woman to be my wife. Shechem is offering way beyond what would be offered. The bride price was already fixed by ancient Near East custom. So Shechem's name your price offer is extraordinarily generous. It's likely guilt driven. And then on top of that, he offers an additional gift, a little bonus to cover over his unacknowledged guilt. Father and son expected immediate acceptance of their offer. But they failed to reckon on the religious scruples of the Jacob family. A simple marriage covenant offer now takes this very dark turn. And Moses hips us to what's going on. Verse 13, the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and his father Hamor deceitfully because he defiled their sister Dinah. The response is one of barely restrained hatred and Jacob-like cunning. Look at verse 14. They said to them, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised. For that would be a disgrace to us." Verse 15. "Only on this condition will we agree with you, that you will become as we are by every male among you being circumcised. Then we'll give our daughters to you, and we'll take your daughters to ourselves, and we will dwell with you and become one people." See the deceit here? We're going to dwell with you and become one people. The very thing they know they can't do. Not one of them mentions Yahweh. Not one of them mentions their covenant relationship with God. This is not evangelism. "But if you will not listen to us and be circumcised, then we'll take our daughter and we'll be gone." They can't take their daughter, not without a fight. They know that. "The offer sounds plausible, though, to the Hamorites, since circumcision was also a pagan ritual for initiation into marriage and into the communal life of other tribes." So what they're offering sounds reasonable because it's done in the area at that time. Okay. "Jacob's sons had no intention, though, of extending Yahweh's blessings to the nation, as the Abrahamic covenant stipulated. You will be a blessing to the nations." This is no blessing to the nations. This is no "come believe in Yahweh and his generous offer. I will be your God. You will be my people. I will dwell with you." Isn't, if you see that, what Hamor is saying? "You will dwell with us and we'll be one people. We will live together." That is God's promise to Abraham. "I'll be your God, you'll be my people, I will live with you." This is the anti-Abrahamic covenant. But Jacob's sons aren't extending God's blessing. Genocide, not evangelism, is their goal. The grotesque irony here is that Shechem's instrument of rape is now becoming the means of his death. And I won't get any more graphic than that. If you can't figure it out, don't worry about it. The brothers' abuse of God's holy covenant is just disgusting. Circumcision was their sign and seal of the Abrahamic covenant. It was the mark of their holiness to Yahweh. And desecrating the covenant sign as a tool for revenge was just pure evil. Idolatrous Shechem was only lusting to own Dinah. Hamor was lusting for more wealth and power. So they strike what they believe is a legitimate contract. And in a shame and honor culture, you don't go back on your word. Now, King Hamor believes he's entered into this mutually beneficial contract to effectively absorb Jacob's family and all of Jacob's property into his little city-state, improving both the economy and the gene pool. And he and his sons return to the city of Shechem to sell their plan to the people. Kent Hughes writes, "Here Hamor and his son showed themselves as masters of deceit as they concealed the Dinah factor and enumerated the domestic and financial pluses while making no mention of their promise to the Israelites. The bottom line selling point was, verse 23, "Will not their livestock, their property, and all their beasts be ours? Only let us agree with them, and they will dwell with us." So Hamor and his son sold all the men in the town on a painful procedure with the promise of wealth and women. And all the able-bodied men of the city-state, including the prince and the king, agree to become and then are circumcised. And then verses 25 through 31, the genocide. The birth order of Dinah's four full brothers was Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. And only Simeon and Levi here do the killing. We know that Reuben, the oldest brother, was the least murderous because he's the one who's going to stop the other brothers from killing snotty young Joseph in chapter 37. He just says, sell him into slavery. So he's not as bad, right? Your call. Judah's failure to participate in this is kind of a mystery. No one knows why he chooses not to do it. Certainly, he is ethically challenged, as we're going to see in chapter 38. In fact, by the time we're done with Genesis, we'll see every tribal leader of the nation of Israel is simultaneously saint and sinner, elect by the free will of God alone, not on the basis certainly of their works. Moses will go out of his way to show us these people are miserable sinners that exist only by the grace of God. The Bible never spares its readers the truth about the depths of sin and its disastrous consequences. These two tribal leaders, one of whom is the direct ancestor of Moses and Aaron, one of whom, this man, the founder of the priestly line, is a murderer. Moses himself would be a murderer. Go figure. Sinners sin. It's what we do. The third day following this rough and painful operation would have been the most painful, the worst day, and in days long before antibiotics, most likely the Hamorites are at least suffering mild to moderate fevers on top of their pain. And all the time, in these 3 days, Simeon and Levi have been sharpening their swords and planning for this. Verse 25, on the third day, when they were sore, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and came against the city while it felt secure and killed all the males. Again, we're not talking about someplace the size of San Antonio. We're not even talking about someplace the size of Castle Hills or Chavano Park. We're talking about a little mud hut compound full of families. Shechem would be a big trading center in the late Bronze Age. This is early Bronze Age. This is just a small place with a few people that are looking to band together with a few other people and get a little bigger. So it doesn't take a lot of killing to go through the town and kill everyone because there's just not a ton of people there, okay? Verse 26, they killed Hamor and his son Shechem, and with the sword, and they killed him with the sword and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went away. So Simeon and Levi go from house to house, stabbing and hacking every male, shoving aside the screaming women and the terrified children, then blood splattered and pumped with adrenaline, they come to Hamor and Shechem's compound. They dispatch the incapacitated servants and their masters. They grab their trembling sister, and they head back where? Towards the altar of El Elohe Israel, the great God that is Israel's God. The rest of Jacob Israel's sons, they hear the report of this slaughter, and they swoop in on the defenseless town like vultures descending on a corpse. And they took everything that wasn't nailed down. They took the livestock and the personal effects and the women and the children for slaves. And all that is left of this thriving trading center was a rotting stack of corpses and ransacked homes. This is now a desolate and depressing picture. Many years later, as Jacob lay on his deathbed, Simeon and Levi would not receive blessings. They would receive anti-blessings. Jacob would say, Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. Let my soul come not into their counsel. Oh, my glory be not joined to their company. For in their anger they killed men, and in their willfulness they hamstrung oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce. And their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Not one person in this sad story comes across blameless. As the Apostle Paul would write to the church in Rome, no one is righteous, no, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside together. They've become worthless. No one does good, not even one. I wonder if Paul had this story in mind particularly as he was writing that. If you would have asked him for an example, I bet he could have rattled off this story of the sons of Jacob at Shechem. The people of Shechem appear to be as greedy and as lustful and idolaters as the sons of Jacob. Dinah is the rebellious teenager who pays for her rebellion with shame and dishonor. The sons of Jacob are diabolical. They use their covenantal status with Yahweh for murder and revenge. And finally, there's Jacob, who's so busy scheming for the proper human wisdom to fix the disaster that he did nothing. And he let his deceitful son steal his headship and devise their evil plot. He speaks no words of concern about or to his only daughter. He says nothing to his other sons who rape and pillage their way through the streets of the town. He only addresses the blood-soaked Simeon and Levi. Verse 30, then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You brought trouble on me by making me a stink to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household." Jacob's blood-splattered sons are defiant. While their father planned and schemed and did nothing, their defiled sister was a hostage to a pagan prince. What did father say about it? Nothing. What did dad do about it? Nothing. Their plan solved the problem once and for all. Verse 31, but they said, "Should he treat our sister like a prostitute?" Notice, our sister, not your daughter. It's not really your daughter because you haven't done anything, Dad. But she's our sister. Moses rarely includes or describes emotion in his narratives. Maybe you've seen that as you've followed along with us through 59 episodes of Genesis now. Most often he leaves the character's motivations and thoughts out and he simply concentrates on the actions, just the facts, ma'am. But there is one recurring motivation in Genesis so far that rears its head in the lives of the major characters, Adam and Eve, Cain, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Israel. What's that factor? Fear. Adam and Eve are afraid of God and they hide. Cain is afraid of men because he's killed his brother. Abraham is pimping his wife to protect himself. Isaac is afraid of Abimelech's power and endangers his wife to protect himself. Jacob is afraid of his brother. He's afraid for his life. He is afraid and terrified as he wrestles the promised seed. He's afraid to enter the promised land without enough flocks. He's afraid to go farther into the land to Bethel because that might be closer to Esau. And he's afraid of reprisal from the Canaanites because of his son's treachery. All of those people received gracious assurances from God. Jacob saw the promised seed face to face, first at Bethel, standing watch over him as he slept, then at the Yabbok, as they wrestled together. And he received his great blessing of a new name, God Fights for You. Like Thomas, Jacob was blessed to see the glorified Christ face to face. That's something you and I haven't done yet, is it? Well, as far as I know, and I don't think anybody here is an apostle or a prophet. We'll get into that some other time, but I'm pretty sure you're not. Yet Jacob, who saw the glorified Christ face to face, feared men and circumstances beyond his control. All circumstances are beyond your control. Do you get that yet? I'll say it again. All circumstances are beyond your control. You are powerless over your addiction to sin. And even if you weren't powerless over addiction to sin, you're not God. God is God. All circumstances are beyond your control. You're not sovereign. You're not God. You are completely Jesus dependent, whether you like it or not. So you can rest in that, or you can get angry and fight and complain amongst yourselves or at other people, or kick at the goads, do whatever you got to do, have your hissy fit. But the truth is, Jesus is in charge. Do you know what the opposite of love is? Good guess. That's what I would say. Hate, right? Elder Simpson nails it. Ding, 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 ding. He gets the free trip to Castle Hills and the furniture suite. Fear. The opposite of love is fear. Not the healthy respect for God kind of fear, which the Bible commands, but being afraid of people or circumstances. Starting with Abraham, four generations are infected with fear. Now, Moses doesn't tell us so, but Simeon and Levi probably killed all the men of the city, not just out of hatred, rather than just Shechem, because he deserved to die. Let's face it, he's a rapist, he's a scumbag, he deserved to die. But not all the men of the city deserve to die. Why would they do that? Out of fear of reprisal. If they don't get them before they get you. Because if I don't get them, they're going to get me. So I better kill them now while I have the chance. That's fear. That's four generations of fear. God is going to say to Levi's descendant Moses, I am the Lord your God. I am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Jacob spent a good deal of time paralyzed by fear. Likely, fear played a large part in his failure to act or speak at the outset of this horrible incident. He's weighing all the consequences, and he's afraid and thinking, how can I protect me and my stuff and my people? What's the best way to go forward? Fear is his only reaction to the grievous, horrible actions of his blood-splattered sons. His new name, given by the promised seed, mind you, is an ironclad guarantee that God would fight for him. But Jacob failed to lovingly trust God, and so he lived in fear, slandering God's promises and scheming out of his fleshly wisdom. Jacob Israel was no different than you and me. We fret over our jobs, our marriages, our children, the course of the world and of our nation. I don't like how stuff is going today. This is horrible. We fret over everything and anything that we can find to fret about because we're certain that we're in control, and you're not. Okay? You are not. Please get that. You're not going to get that. I don't get it. That's why I have elders to remind me all the time that I'm not in control. We take on circumstances beyond our control and we scheme for ways to control them. Fear is the opposite of love, but God graciously provides a remedy. And the last living apostle preached to his tiny, struggling church in Ephesus. And he said this, there's no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not been perfected in love. Now, what is this perfect love of which John writes? Well, he's not telling us to love perfectly, because we're never going to do that in this life. It's not our perfect love that casts out fear. It's God's perfect love that banishes fear. Our fears. John defines love this way. In this, the love of God was made manifest among us, that God sent his only Son into the world so that we might live through him. In this is the love. There's a definite article there. I translate it because I think it's important. In this is the love, not that we have been loving God, but that he himself loved us and sent out his son, the propitiation for our sin. When we fear, we're in good company. Four generations of Abraham's seed feared circumstance and failed to love. One member of that generation, by the way, after a lot of suffering, is going to break that cycle of fear, which makes him a Christ figure to come in this story. His name is Joseph, the same guy who's pillaging and raping his way through this town, by the way. But when we love, we're in the best company, for we're walking with Jesus, who has fought and won for us by living the perfect life we can never live, by dying the death our sin deserves, by defeating sin in his resurrection and ascending to heaven's throne to rule sovereignly over all things that we unlovingly fear. If you're here this morning and you're not trusting into his perfect life and his atoning death for your sin, then you should fear. You should be very, very afraid. But you don't have to be anymore. You don't, because you can trust him right now. All you have to do is say, thank you, Lord Jesus, for living and dying for me. And may you have no rest and no peace until you come to rest in him whom to know is life eternal, even Jesus Christ, the promised seed. Amen.